Welcome to 30 Minutes of VOA Learning English, the voice of America's information service for people learning English. Join us now for our daily magazine show, As It Is, and other programs designed for English learners.
Hello again from Washington. We come to you every day to help you learn and improve your American English skills. At the same time, we tell about interesting things and events in our world. We will begin today with news about a new museum here in the United States. Its purpose is to show this country's diplomatic relations throughout its history. Mary Gottschall joins us with all we need to know. Mary?
Consider this. There are more than 400 museums in the U.S. that celebrate the history of the military, but not a single one devoted to American diplomacy. That's about to change. A new museum celebrating the history of American diplomacy is being built at the U.S. Department of State. The U.S. Diplomacy Center will feature 238 years of American diplomatic history, as well as an education area for students interested in diplomatic careers. The USDC project is unprecedented. The nation's first education center and interactive museum dedicated to inspiring and educating the public about the history, practice, and challenges of American diplomacy, said Kathy A. Johnson, director of the USDC. The U.S. Diplomacy Center has collected over 6,200 objects to display in the new 20,000-square-foot museum. Among them is a portion of the Berlin Wall after it fell in 1989. Diplomacy is not quite the world's oldest profession, but it remains one of the most misunderstood, wrote William Burns, a veteran American diplomat. Burns recently retired after spending 33 years at the U.S. Department of State. He is president of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. The work of American diplomats has never been more important or more worthwhile, he wrote in Foreign Policy in October 2014. However, the American public may not be aware of the contributions of American diplomacy. Sometimes it is the simple things that can start a diplomatic movement. Among the museum's collection is a ping pong paddle given to former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger by Chinese table tennis champion Zhuang Zedong in 2007. Zhuang's chance meeting with a member of the U.S. table tennis team in 1971 led to ping-pong diplomacy with China during the early 1970s, said the USDC. Kissinger's diplomacy led to an historic accord between China and the United States. It was the first U.S. contact with China since the communists had come to power. The museum will show the achievements of American diplomats from the earliest days of the country. Benjamin Franklin, for example, was America's first U.S. diplomat who won support for the American Revolution and negotiated peace with Great Britain. Although the USDC is still under construction, it has a social media presence. Their Facebook and Twitter posts showcase USDC artifacts, highlight dates in U.S. diplomatic history, and promote their ongoing education programs. In addition, the USDC website, Discover Diplomacy, draws about 140,000 unique visitors per month. It provides snapshots of work that U.S. diplomats conduct on a variety of issues around the world according to the USDC. The new museum will have a special hall devoted to education. Students can engage in mock diplomatic talks. The goal is to inspire young people to pursue careers in diplomacy. There will also be interactive maps and displays to illustrate how an embassy functions. We are building partnerships with universities and community colleges around the country that will enable us to develop conferences, programs, and media tools tailored to a student audience, said Johnson. Building started on the museum in 2014. Secretary of State John Kerry, along with five former secretaries of state, were present for the ceremony. Once all the funding and design plans are completed, the museum is projected to open in 2017, said a spokesman for the project. Private sector donors have provided $47 million to build the museum, according to the Diplomacy Center Foundation. The foundation is a nonprofit organization that is raising the money for the museum from various corporations, individuals, and foundations. It still needs to raise an additional $20 million. I'm Mary Gottschall.
You are listening to The Voice of America, and we are coming to you from Washington. Chinese officials have announced that their military will soon get smaller. Whenever that happens, many former soldiers find themselves out of work. In this case, the national government has stepped in to help solve the problem.
State-owned companies must employ soldiers who will seek work when the Chinese military is reduced. In September, President Xi Jinping announced the military would drop in size from 2.3 million troops to 2 million. The official People's Liberation Army daily newspaper noted a central government agency said resettling and receiving ex-servicemen is connected to the overall picture of military construction and social harmony and stability. The order would hurt state-owned companies. Some have reduced their workforce to be more competitive as the Chinese economy slows. Almost all of the country's oil, coal, electricity, steel, and cement companies are state-owned. They have suffered heavy losses over the past 2 years. Jeffrey Crothall is the communications director of the China Labor Bulletin in Hong Kong. He said he believes some state-owned companies will refuse to employ the returning soldiers. He says many of them do not have enough money to hire any new workers. Experts believe the government expects some of the state-owned companies will refuse to hire the soldiers. State media report that the government has already made plans to deal with the resistance. The PLA Daily newspaper said state-owned companies should not take actions that may hurt the former soldiers. They should not limit how many of them they employ. Some of the leaders of the state-owned companies have been watched closely in recent years as China investigates and punishes corruption. This means that the leaders of the companies are not likely to refuse jobs to former soldiers. But Crothall said many state-owned companies are hiring temporary contractors rather than employees. He said many companies stopped being profitable months or years ago. They have had to ask for money from local governments so they can continue to operate. If the companies are forced to employ former soldiers, they would likely need even more financial help from the government. That would mean the government is still paying the wages of the former soldiers, even though they are no longer in the military.
Coming up, more programs designed for English learners. You can read and listen to our reports and download MP3s at learningenglish.voanews.com. You can learn with us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube at VOA Learning English.
Flying robots, called drones, may be one of the most important technologies of the future. The number of jobs for people who know how to design, build, and control them is increasing. Because of this increase, several U.S. universities and colleges started offering degrees in unmanned aerial systems, or UAS. One of these universities is the University of Washington in Seattle. Christopher Lum is an aeronautics research scientist with the university's Autonomous Flight Systems Laboratory. Lum helps students explore how civilian drones can safely share the skies with regular aircraft. Ryan Volek loves the 3 years he spent in the flight lab. One of the coolest parts is working with industries and all the cool technology we work with. It is definitely an opportunity that a lot of students don't usually get, he said. Ward Handley is seeking a master's degree in aeronautics and astronautics at the University of Washington. When the drone program first began, he did not think it was a good idea. I decided, no, I do not want to work on drones because of the privacy issues, he said. Drones can be used to invade people's privacy. But when an offer for a paid position in the drone lab appeared, Handley changed his opinion. However, the Federal Aviation Administration, or FAA, is creating new rules to control the use of drones. The FAA is the part of the U.S. government that controls air travel and traffic. A new FAA law requires drone owners to register their drones. All drones must be registered in a government database by February 19, 2016. People who do not register their drones could face fines of up to $20,000. Changing current rules may present problems for students looking for drone pilot experience. One problem for many schools' unmanned aerial systems programs is finding a legal place to fly. In Seattle, University of Washington student Alec Buing showed off the place where his department tests the drones. It's just a big room that we move the tables and chairs out of. If it happens to get out of control towards the windows, we reduce any damage, he explained. Lum explained why they test drones inside a building. He said it takes a very long time to get official permission to fly outside. The federal laws are a little bit restricting. We need to register our aircraft. We need to get what is called a certificate of authorization, Lum said. That process can take months. The FAA wants to replace its current way of examining requests to register drones. Now the FAA looks at each case differently. The organization wants to create a national rule for civil UAS and UAS used for business later in 2016. At this time, Kansas State University is the only school with permission to offer unmanned aircraft flight classes to students outside, an FAA representative wrote. The FAA selected Kansas State and 15 other universities to be part of a national academic research group called the Center of Excellence for UAS. The group will receive federal money to expand research and training. Lum and some of his students recently moved their research to Australia. Australia has fewer rules governing UAS. A professor at Western Washington University also took his department's drones to Canada for the same reason. I'm Pete Musto.
Thank you. Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The 1880s were years of important change in American business and industry. 20 years after the Civil War, the United States had become one of the leading industrial nations of the world. As the number of factories increased, so did competition between businesses. Some industrialists cooperated with their competitors to reduce competition. But this did not always succeed. There was no legal way to enforce their agreements. This week in our series, Leo Scully and Jack Weitzel tell how these issues were handled during the administration of President Benjamin Harrison.
In 1879, a new form of business organization was developed, the trust. In a trust, stock owners of many competing companies give control of their stock to a committee or group of trustees. The trustees operate all the companies as one and pay profits to the stockholders. The profits would be high because there would be no competition to drive down prices. One of the first trusts was formed by John D. Rockefeller in the oil industry. The stockholders of 77 oil companies gave control of their stock to 9 trustees of Rockefeller's Standard Oil Company. The 9 men controlled 90% of the nation's oil production.
The success of the Standard Oil Company led to the creation of trusts in other industries. Soon, there was a sugar trust, a salt trust, a steel trust, even a whiskey trust. These huge corporations represented hundreds of millions of dollars. This great wealth made them very powerful. Former President Cleveland, himself a friend of business, warned of a growing danger. Corporations, he said, should be carefully controlled creatures of the law and servants of the people. Instead, they are fast becoming the people's masters.
The public began to demand government controls of the trusts. Farmers claimed that prices were too high, and they blamed the trusts. Workers said their unions could not negotiate with the new industrial giants. Small businessmen charged that trusts were too powerful. They said the trusts could destroy them. Public demands for action led the governments of 15 states to pass antitrust laws. But the state laws could do nothing. Most of the trusts were nationwide corporations, which did business in many states. Public protest was so great that both parties in the 1888 elections promised to pass a federal law against trusts.
A number of such bills were proposed. One, offered by Senator John Sherman, a Republican, was approved by Congress. President Benjamin Harrison signed it into law in 1890. The Sherman antitrust law sounded severe. It said it was illegal for a trust or any other organization to interfere with interstate commerce, trade among the states. It was also illegal for any person or organization to form a monopoly, to get control of a whole industry. The law ordered harsh punishment for any person found guilty of these crimes. It sounded like a strong law, but it was not. It was written in a very general way that left the courts to decide what the law really said. Opponents of the Sherman antitrust bill said its purpose was not to destroy trusts, but to make the public believe that trusts would be destroyed.
During President Harrison's administration, only 8 corporations were accused of violating the new antitrust law. Of the 8, only 1 was found guilty, and only in a very limited way. The first company charged was the Whiskey Trust. A court dismissed the case. It said the government failed to prove that the trust had interfered with interstate commerce. A few years later, the government asked the courts to break up the huge Sugar Trust, which controlled 98% of the sugar-producing industry. The Supreme Court refused to do so. It said that it was true the trust had formed a monopoly in the sugar-producing industry, but it said the monopoly was in manufacturing, not in trade or interstate commerce. Therefore, said the High Court, the Sugar Trust was legal and did not violate the antitrust law.
Industrial trusts helped to reduce competition among American companies. High tariffs also gave some protection from competition with foreign companies. But business leaders were not satisfied. They demanded even higher taxes on imports to further reduce competition. So Republican Congressman William McKinley of Ohio proposed a new tariff bill, one that would raise import taxes higher than ever before. The tax already was about 38% on most imported products. The new measure would raise it to almost 50%.
Not everyone in the Harrison administration supported the high tariff measure. Secretary of State Blaine wanted to increase trade between the United States and other countries. He warned that new high tariffs would destroy those plans. Blaine also opposed the bill because he felt it would hurt the Republican Party politically. In a letter to Congressman McKinley, Blaine said the bill would anger the farmers by adding as much as 8% to the price of shoes for their children. Such movements as this for protection, said Blaine, will move the Republican Party only into speedy defeat.
Most Western and Southern congressmen opposed the tariff bill because it would mean higher prices to the people of their states. But the bill could not pass without the support of some of them. So supporters of the tariff bill offered a deal. If Westerners voted for the tariff measure, then Eastern lawmakers would support a silver purchase bill that the Westerners wanted. The bill, known as the Sherman Silver Purchase Act, would have the government buy 4.5 million ounces of silver each month. The government would pay for the silver with paper money, treasury notes, which could be exchanged for gold or silver money.
Western mines were producing huge amounts of silver. By selling it to the government, the mining interests hoped to keep the price of silver from falling. Western interests spoke in Congress now with a much stronger voice. In 1889 and 1890, six Western territories became states. This added 12 more Western representatives in the Senate and others in the House. The deal was agreed to. Both the McKinley Tariff Bill and the Sherman Silver Purchase Bill were approved by Congress and signed by President Harrison. As expected, the price of imported goods rose, and the people blamed the Republicans.
In the congressional elections of 1890, the Republican Party suffered heavy losses. The Republican majority in the Senate was cut to 8, and not all the Republican senators would support the party on every issue. The Republicans lost control in the House of Representatives. Only 88 were elected to House seats. Democrats elected 235 representatives. Voters also elected 9 House members and 2 senators from a new political organization, the People's Party. The new party was born in farming areas of the West and South. It was a party of protest, formed by men who refused to support either of the two old parties.
Years before, farmers had united in agricultural organizations they called granges. A national grange had been formed. During hard times, the grange organized political action groups to help elect officials who were friendly to farmers. But as farm conditions improved, the granges began to disappear. A few years later, farmers began to build new organizations. Like the granges, they began as social and economic groups. By the late 1880s, many of these groups had united into 2 large organizations. One, with more than 1 million members, was the Southern Alliance. The other, with fewer members, was the National Farmers Alliance. Members of the 2 groups began to unite for political action. And that will be our story on the next program of The Making of a Nation.
Our program was written by Frank Beardsley. The narrators were Leo Scully and Jack Weitzel. You can find our series online with transcripts, MP3s, podcasts, and images at voaspecialenglish.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter at VOA Learning English. Join us again next week for The Making of a Nation, an American history series in VOA Special English.